out to James Fenimore Cooper, Samuel F.B. Morse, Oliver Wendell Holmes, Charles Sumner, Mary Cassatt, John Singer Sargent, and Henry James all have in common. Well, while many of their fellow 19th century Americans were migrating west towards a manifest destiny, they chose to travel east to spend their most formative years abroad in Paris. And as David McCullough writes in his new book, The Greater Journey, Americans in Paris, from 1830 to 1900, a mix of artists, writers, educators, doctors, and politicians would go on to become some of the most influential Americans in their respective fields. Mr. McCullough is a two-time winner of both the Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Award. He's also received the Presidential Medal of Freedom. His new book is published by Simon & Schuster, and I'm very pleased to welcome him back to our show today. Hello. Is this your first book set outside the United States?
No, because my Panama book, while not entirely outside the United States, was to a very great degree outside the United States.
Well,
much of it was set in France, too.
Well, we consider Panama to be part of the United States for a long
well,
time.
Well, we certainly did for a while.
So how many of your previous subjects had spent time in Paris?
John Adams spent a good deal of time there and served in an important role during the years of the Revolution and afterward, and I did research about that in Paris. Harry Truman fought in World War I in France, so I had to walk the walk of Truman's World War I experiences, and I've been interested in France, interested in Paris since 50 years ago this spring when my wife and I went for the first time.
For the first time, really?
Yeah.
Well, your book begins in 1830, and as you mentioned, John Adams, he was one of a number of founding fathers who spent time in Paris. But their stays must have been different than the ones you're discussing here, because this is from 1830 to 1900 and before Harry Truman
wound up
in Paris.
Yes, I wanted to do something that had a period that had not been written about. The Adams, Franklin, Jefferson 18th century period had been done, and I felt I'd done it myself. And, of course, the 1920s, 30s, the Gertrude Stein, Fitzgerald time. The Woody Allen time, been done again and again. And here was this big slice of American experience between 1830 and 1900, about which very little had been written. And it's filled, as you just suggested, with some very important and extremely interesting characters. And the fact that they're interesting, to me, is far more appealing than that they are important.
Well, some of these people, like James Fenimore Cooper and Mary Cassatt, are well known. But you also tell the stories of some relatively obscure people. How did you find them?
You just look around in the research and the reading you do, and you turn them up. I was delighted to come upon people I knew nothing about. George Healy, Elizabeth Blackwell, the first American woman to become a doctor.
George Healy was a painter I'd never heard of.
George Healy was a painter I did not know, but there are seven of his paintings hanging in the White House. He is a major portrait painter of that era on both sides of the Atlantic, an Irish kid from Boston who had talent, but he realized that if he wanted to be really good, he had to get training, and there were no art schools here. So despite the fact that he had no money, no contacts in Paris, knew not a word of French, he went off to study in Paris.
You express regret that more of the Americans who were living in Paris didn't keep written records of what was going on at the time. Are some of these people in your book there simply because they did write about their experiences?
Yes, that's true. But if they didn't have any experiences that were of any particular appeal or interest, that didn't qualify. And my criteria were that they had to be there because they had an admirable purpose, that they were ambitious to excel, and that they all of them brought something home, either figuratively or literally, an idea or a work of art or something that changed us, not just was an accomplishment of note on their part.
I'm assuming that's why you've called your book The Greater Journey.
Yes. The first journey was the voyage over the Atlantic in the era before steam navigation began. And it was horrendous, a month at best. And when they landed on the mainland of France and for example, saw their first great European masterpiece, which was the cathedral at Rouen, that signaled to almost all of them that they were in for something far beyond their experience. And they wrote about it. And one of the biggest adjustments was the presence of age, as one of them called the prestige of age. Here was a building that was infinitely bigger than anything in their own country and was built before Columbus ever sailed.
But why were they choosing to go to Paris rather than London, although many of these people also spent time in London? Henry James lived much of his life in
England.
Well,
if you were a medical student, you went to Paris because it was the medical capital of the world. The finest medical training, the finest medical advances were in Paris. That was the Mecca for medicine. If you were a painter, there was no question that's where you went. If you were a sculptor, there was no. And an architect. And again, there were no schools of architecture in this country. Augustus St. Gaudens, the American sculptor whose work is well known here in New York, was the first American ever admitted to the École des Beaux-Arts as a sculptor. And he like Healy, was a kid off the streets, put to work by his immigrant shoemaker father when he was 13 years old, and he goes over to make something of himself. These are very American quests, but they're quests pursued in the other direction, as you said at the beginning.
Although I was surprised to discover that, because I always assumed that, based on his name, that he was French, had come here and established himself as an American sculptor.
His father was French. His mother was Irish.
And we're talking about not just art and medicine, architecture, but also education.
Education, indeed. Emma Willard, who was the first woman in America to champion higher education for women. And even those people who went over for a specific training in a specific science or art craft or skill came back and taught. They became teachers. Oliver Wendell Holmes, who was a noted poet and essayist and a medical doctor, taught anatomy at the Harvard Medical School for over 35 years. St. Gaudens taught. They felt they had to share what they'd learned and to bring our level of culture, not just the performance of culture, but appreciation of it on the part of the people.
Yeah, only a few of them became real expatriates because they felt that it was important for them to come back and share what they'd learned?
Yes, but it was also not in the spirit of the times. None of them went over because he was disenchanted with his own country or that he felt alienated from his own country. That came later after World War I.
My guest is David McCullough, whose latest book is The Greater Journey, Americans in Paris. It's published by Simon & Schuster. We'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with David McCullough, who has won both the Pulitzer and the National Book Award two times each, also received the Presidential Medal of Freedom for his various books about American history. This one, a bit of a departure. It's called The Greater Journey, Americans in Paris, and it covers the years 1830 to 1900. You mentioned that there was – that the early waves, the early expats came over under the worst of conditions. Things changed over the years as steamboats became available. So were there times when everybody wanted to come over and then there was a lull and then again another wave of migration?
It kept increasing steadily after 1848 or so when the first steamboats were plying the waters. Steam navigation made a huge difference because you could schedule departures on a specific day at a specific time. You didn't have to tack back and forth across the Atlantic. You went straight.
And you got there quicker.
You got there much quicker. You got there in less than half the time. And you also, they began to make accommodations for passengers, which was never the case before. And eventually, really quite quickly, you had luxurious travel on steamships to Paris. At first, it was more for the affluent element of society, people could afford it, and it became fashionable to go and go for an extended time and take your whole family. But by the 1900, all kinds of people were going, and women could go too without feeling they had to have a male chaperone or a female chaperone.
It's kind of ironic because at the same time, there were waves of immigrants coming to the United States from Europe who were desperate to get away.
Yes.
The first group of people who traveled to Paris in the 1830s speak French or know much about the French culture?
No, they knew nothing about the French culture, and they did not speak French with some rare exceptions, because modern European languages weren't yet taught. So that even an educated young man from Harvard or Yale or some such place would probably speak no French whatsoever. And keep in mind, many of them are going to be plunged immediately into the medical school in Paris with thousands of students, going to lectures, going to demonstrations of surgical procedures.
All in French.
Not knowing a word. And they had to catch up rapidly about that. Also, it's very interesting to know and important to understand that if you got to Paris and you were an American and thus a foreigner, you could go to the Sorbonne or you could go to the medical school for free. There was no charge. So all you had to pay for was your room and board.
Were there guidebooks that they could consult, Paris on 5 francs a day or something like that?
Yes. Galignani's guidebook was an English language guidebook. It was about that thick, and it was about pocket size.
You've shown about 3 inches.
And everybody carried one. And I've had one right close to my desk the whole time I was writing the book.
You're right that some of these people were shocked to realize that for the first time in their lives that they were foreigners.
Yes, never had that experience. And they were shocked to find out how French Paris was. Not that they should have been shocked, but that nothing was English in English. Nobody spoke English. Nobody knew anything about America, and they couldn't believe that. And it took an adjustment. They were shocked by all kinds of things, that wine was cheaper than milk, that dogs were welcome everywhere, into restaurants and so forth.
Still are, and not here, still.
And that none of the men spit, because back here everybody was chewing tobacco and spitting all the time.
Were there expat enclaves? Because that's what happened later.
There were what they called American communities, and these were very often diplomats or business people or professional people that were there for those reasons. But this student element was all on the left bank. They were living la vida boheme.
Well, we know that Samuel Morse and James Fenimore Cooper were close friends, and also, American medical students studied together at the École de Médecine, worked closely with each other. But when I heard that James Fenimore Cooper was one of the people who went there, I thought he was such an odd candidate for an extended stay in Paris. I mean, this is a man who wrote about the American frontier, wrote The Last of the Mohicans.
Yes, he's over there and living in splendor, by the way, because he was immensely successful. The Last of the Mohicans made him known internationally. He was the first international celebrity, American writer who became a celebrity. And so he lived in style, whereas his pal Morse was living very modestly.
Samuel Morse was a painter in those days.
Morse was a painter, and he painted what was the masterpiece of his painting career inside the gallery of the Louvre Museum. But he also came back with an idea, which was for the Telegraph. And then he went back again to Paris to secure a patent for his French patent for his telegraph. And while he was there, he met Daguerre, who had invented photography, or the daguerreotype, as it was known. And with Daguerre's permission, he brought photography back to the United States, set up what was the first studio for photographic portraits anywhere in the country, right here in New York. Morse was a phenomenal creative man who was not without his complications, but his life story hangs on that Paris experience, as does the life story of so many of them.
And for many of them, the Louvre was the center of Paris.
Yes, and there were no art galleries in the United States, you couldn't go and look at masterpieces in the Metropolitan Museum or some such place. So when they first got there, and they all write about this, and they go to the Louvre, they simply can't believe it. Harriet Beecher Stowe, for example, decided to set herself down in front of one masterpiece after another, just look at it and think about it. And her reaction to Jericho's Raft of the Medusa is one of the most fascinating studies by a novice trying to figure out a painting I've ever read.
They also had not had experiences of public gardens and spaces of the sort that we find in Paris. Later, of course, I don't know whether we wound up with Central Park and Prospect Park and some of the other public spaces as a result of these people coming back and saying, why don't we have that?
Yes, we did. John Sanderson, a writer from Philadelphia, sat there writing in his journal, why in the world don't we have parks like this in our country? And then, of course, the architects like Richard Morris Hunt, who did the design, the Metropolitan Museum of Art, H.H. Richardson, Louis Sullivan, came back and changed the look of our country all around us.
Not all the Americans approved of the French aesthetic. Weren't some of them a bit overwhelmed by the nude statuary in the Garden of the Tuileries?
Well, yes, they were. Emma Willard was shocked by it. I think what impressed them as much as the fact of the nudity of the statues that nobody defaced anything in the public gardens. There were there's no graffiti. Nobody marks things up. And they were stunned by how polite the French were.
Of course, now there's a lot more graffiti in Europe than there is in the United States. We went through our phase. I guess now it's their turn. But people were also shocked by how open the prostitution was.
Yes, and understandably, because it was very apparent everywhere.
Now, you mentioned that people went there to study medicine. Wasn't there a cholera epidemic in Paris at the time?
Yes, in the 1830s, 1832, there was a horrific cholera epidemic, the worst and first cholera epidemic and the worst ever to hit Europe. And in less than 6 months in Paris, 18,000 people died. And Morse was trying to paint his painting in the Louvre at this point. And what that painting doesn't show is this terrible tragedy that's happening outside the walls of the museum. And to keep Morse's morale up, his friend Cooper came to be with him, talk with him, watch him work every single afternoon. It's a great story of a friend in need being a friend indeed, of friendship under the most adverse pressure imaginable.
Another irony is that none of the Americans got sick while they were in Paris, but there were thousands of Americans dying of cholera back home.
When it hit the United States, yes, indeed.
Now, there were medical schools here. The difference is that if you went to Paris, you could practice on cadavers, and
yes,
also you could work on female patients. That would have been considered unseemly in an American medical school?
There was a great stigma about doctors, about men, since all doctors were men at that point, having a man examine your body if you were a woman. And most American women at that time would have preferred to die than to have that happen to them. And as a consequence, a great many died. In Paris, there was no such stigma, and these young medical students made the rounds with doctors examining female patients.
They also discovered different attitudes about race. Charles Sumner, when he went to the Sorbonne, had black classmates for the first time.
And saw for the first time, and it stunned him, that these young black students had the same kinds of aspirations he did, that they were treated exactly the same as everybody else and acted exactly the same. And he wrote in his journal, perhaps how we treat African-American people at home has more to do with what we've been taught than the natural order of things. And it transformed him. It was an epiphany for him. He came home, devoted the rest of his life to fighting slavery, and became the most powerful voice of abolition in the United States Senate, almost at the cost of his life, because a Southern congressman famously attacked him with a heavy walking stick and nearly beat him to death.
Now, we've been talking about the effect of Paris on the Americans, but Americans were having an effect on France at the same time, weren't they? P.T. Barnum, for example.
Well, P.T. Barnum hit town like nobody ever had, as did George Catlin, the great painter of the American Plains Indians, who came with a band of his Iowa friends, Iowa Indians.
So they saw Native Americans for the first time.
They saw Native Americans for the first time, and it was a point where Rousseau theme of the original Native man being the superior. That's why people like Delacroix were going off to paint Arab chieftains with their lions and so forth. And no American artist was ever greeted in Paris with such acclaim and such fanfare. But we also, of course, had our own inventions and discoveries coming to Europe, the light bulb, the telephone, which would transform Europe no less than it had this country. And when Morse invented the telegraph, that too hugely affected relations, communication between France and the United States and all over Europe.
And many of these people went to Paris when they were very young, Edith Wharton, Henry James, Mary Cassatt, even Teddy Roosevelt. And then return later.
Yes.
Not Teddy Roosevelt, but he went back to France, didn't he?
Yes, he did. Had his honeymoon there.
Did they had Paris changed? Had they been changed?
Well, Paris had changed enormously. In the period that I'm writing about, between 1830 and 1900, is the period when Napoleon III redid Paris under George Haussmann.
But they were also there during periods of political turmoil, 1848.
Yes, and the worst of all was the Franco-Prussian War, the siege of Paris by the German army, where they starved Paris into surrendering, and then the hideous commune that followed, a civil war, where people were executed by the thousands indiscriminately, one of the most horrible human spasms ever.
How aware were the Americans of what was really going on?
Well, most of the Americans that were in Paris got out, but there were few that did not get out, and most notably our minister to Paris, Elihu Washburn, who not only stayed because he felt it was his duty to stay as long as there were Americans there, but who kept a diary through all of it and left us a vivid portrait every single day of what was happening.
During the war with the Prussians, the Tuileries Palace was burned. There was open violence on the street, and the art in the Louvre was under
very
attack.
Threatened, almost destroyed.
The Venus de Milo only survived because of a fortunate accident.
Well, but survived because they hit it in a very skillful way. The Communards, as they were known, tried to burn Paris, and in one particular night, it looked as if they were going to succeed.
So when medicine changed in this country and medical schools opened, in fact, one of the painters who went to Paris, Thomas Aikens, painted one of his most famous paintings about a clinic in Philadelphia. Did future doctors not go to Paris anymore?
By the time Oliver Wendell Holmes went back for a visit when he was in his 70s, the number of American medical students there had diminished to very few because there was no longer a need. The difference between the advanced state of Paris medicine with our state of medical training had narrowed appreciably, and mainly because of these very students who came back.
Now, the artists continued going. We mentioned Aikens, Mary Cassatt, Augustus St. Gaudens, John Singer Sargent. Later, we had a whole group of others who went in the teens and the 20s.
Yes.
And even after World War II, although it all really changed when New York became the center.
That's
of the
right.
art
after
world.
After World War II,
and French people started coming here.
That's right.
So you've covered Paris. I assume that you have another project in the works. But before you tell us about it, David McCullough will be speaking with Adam Gopnik at the 92nd Street Y tonight at 8. For tickets and more information, you can go to our show page at WNYC.org. The book, his latest book, The Greater Journey, Americans in Paris, is published by Simon & Schuster. And do you have another project in the works?
Well, let's just say I'm thinking about it, but I'm not ready to talk about it yet.
Well, can you tell us whether it will take place in this country or in some foreign land?
No, I can't.
Meanwhile, I want to thank you so much for being with us again. It's always fascinating talking about American history with David McCullough, winner of 2 Pulitzer Prizes and 2 National Book Awards.
Thank you, sir, very much.